lovely. Wait, what's going on? No! It's...
November.
The bleakest month has arrived, so warm up with November's issue of Discorder. This month's cover article is an interview with space rockers Dada Plan, who make
dystopian
music for our
dystopian
times. We're also featuring articles on dark punk trio Lie, experimental folk rock from Colin Cowan, and alt garage nutrition from Monk. And please enjoy a special staff sound off on
our least favorite album from an artist we love.
So cozy down with a copy of Discorder, available around town, in the fight of the November Blues. Special thanks to this month's advertisers, AMS Events, LiveVan.com, The Fox Cabaret, The Lido, The Rickshaw Theater, and Vinyl Records.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, the 14th of November. I'm Costa Perdanovich.
And I'm Alex Sarah Davis. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:15 p.m. and a time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news. Today's top stories and segments are, first, our science and tech segment, by correspondent Marco. He's going to talk about his recent science findings.
We also have news correspondent Emily Blake's interviews with Dr. Doris Doucette and Anne Berthisel about concerns about UBC researchers using animal research.
Later in the program, an interview with Professor James Ridge from the Vantage College to discuss some of the concerns which have been raised about their program, as well as a brief discussion with City Council candidate Ludwig Skalicki about his experiences running as an independent candidate in the upcoming Vancouver elections.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, the opening of the new sub has been delayed once again due to construction. For the third time since the initial plan date of September 2014, the new sub opening date has been pushed back, now opening at the beginning of April. As before, when it was pushed back to January 5th and then again to February 23rd, the delays are being attributed to unforeseen construction problems. One of these problems is reportedly an issue with the slatted panels, or fins, being used for the performance space in the main areas of the building. The delays have caused general frustration in the UBC community, and many students express doubt that the multi-million dollar project will ever be completed. In the face of this growing skepticism, VP Admin Ava Nasiri has stated this date is more manageable and likely to be final. Quote, "The opening date has been realistically set as early April. We were optimistic for an earlier date, but the major asterisk that came with the February date was to allow the construction and consulting teams to sit down for a sufficient amount of time and revise the schedule to something realistic." According to the same sources, the AMS will begin the move from the old sub in March, and the completed new sub will open its doors to students in early April.
In local news, Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba is considering coming to Vancouver. It is rumored that the wholesale trading group Alibaba is thinking about setting up offices here. James Moore, Canada's industry minister, leaked the information in a tweet early this week, writing, quote, "Had a great meeting with Alibaba.com CEO Jack Ma. Alibaba is seriously considering a new campus in Vancouver." The e-retailer raked in a jaw-dropping $9 billion in sales over 24 hours during the Singles Day promotion. Singles Day is widely considered to be one of the Chinese equivalent of North America's Cyber Monday. Mayor Gregor Robertson expressed enthusiasm for the potential Alibaba branch, telling CTV News, quote, "We're hopeful that Alibaba chooses North America. That would be a big coup for our city, really important for Canada, and really strengthening connections between China and Canada." If the rumor is true, it would be good news for those of us looking for jobs in one of the world's fastest-growing industries. The move would greatly benefit Vancouver both economically and socially, and reinforce the city's reputation as a tech hub in Canada.
Vancouver School Board's transgender policy spurs parent lawsuit. The Vancouver School Board's recent policy that allows transgendered students to use the bathroom of their choice and to be identified by the pronoun of their choice has proven to be controversial with some parents. A group of almost 200 parents have filed a petition against the policy with the BC Supreme Court. They argue that the policy violates public decency. The petition reads, quote, "Some students are uncomfortable with sharing very personal information or private spaces with members of the opposite sex, and deeply care about their privacy when using the washroom or change room," adding that the school board has yet to propose a solution to this problem. On the other hand, one parent, mother to a 16-year-old transgendered son, feels the policy is a way to be more inclusive. The mother, Jane Duff, said, quote, "It's acknowledging who they feel they are, and I think it's a very, very sad division that has clearly arisen in our community." The issue has spread into the political realm as well. Trustee Ken Denique, up for re-election, said, quote, "I think it's appropriate for the parents to challenge the policy this way. There's a concern that they are not being treated equally. There's a concern that when they go out to public sessions, they do not get a fair break and that they're being spoken down to by the professionals." However, Board Chair Patty Backus, also running for re-election, rebutted Denique's argument, saying, quote, "There was a lot of misunderstanding and I think there was a lot of fear-mongering that went on. This whole issue is about making students feel safe." Concerned parents counter by arguing that the policies violate the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms in respect to privacy of non-trans students. This topic will likely surface as an issue in the upcoming elections. No response has yet been filed by the Vancouver School Board.
The Vancouver civic election is tomorrow. We here at News 101 would like to remind you about tomorrow, Saturday, November 15th, election here in Vancouver. If you want to find out how to register to vote, please go to www.vancouver.ca and click on Vancouver Votes in the sidebar. We wish all candidates the best of luck.
In national news, new reports suggest that the recession has spurred graduates back to school. Youth unemployment in Canada reached its peak in the summer of 2009 at around 8%, following the global economic recession. Ever since then, the numbers have slowly been climbing to around 6.5% where they sit currently. I think that was slowly been declining. The report by Statistics Canada suggests that youth with undergraduate degrees took the lack of employment as an opportunity to return to school. The report also suggests that students who enrolled in co-op programs are currently earning significantly more than those who did not. While the recent upward trend is promising, it is all too easy to assume that youth employment has stabilized. With many students returning to the market after having earned their graduate degrees, only time will tell what the future has to offer Canada's youth.
In international news, homeschooling may prove to validate a validated alternative to public and private education. In one remarkable case, Belicia Cespedes of Canyon County, California, may be the youngest certified public accountant in the world at only 17 years old. Belicia, along with her three sisters, were all homeschooled and had flexible programs that were designed by their parents and themselves. The goal was to focus on their interests and abilities, with each sister only being allowed to move on once they were able to demonstrate mastery over a subject. This system of homeschooling proved impressively effective, with all four siblings earning their high school diplomas between the ages of 11 and 14. In addition, they all expressed their having benefited from learning at a personal pace. Since finishing high school, the sisters began to receive college credit through the United States College Level Examination Board, and Belisha has already earned a bachelor's degree in business. Contrary to popular belief, these young women don't appear to have missed out on opportunities to interact with other people their age. Belisha was constantly enrolled in sports and has had 2 years of part-time work experience under a licensed accountant. When asked about the future, Belisha said, quote, "Working with people is exciting to me, not nerve-wracking. The only thing I'd be nervous about is not having an answer when someone else is there to ask me for help. I feel more comfortable around an older crowd. I always have." In the wake of the BC teachers' legal dispute with the provincial government, Belisha may be taken as an example of an alternative to public and private systems. Her remarkable case shows what can happen when dedicated parents take the time to educate their children in their own hands.
The Keystone XL pipeline continues to gain traction in the United States. The newly Republican-dominated House passed a pro-Keystone XL bill by a 252-161 vote. This marks the House of Representatives' ninth successful attempt to pass a pro-Keystone XL bill. However, President Obama's administration still remains unconvinced that the pipeline will offer much to Americans. The Obama administration claims that Canada seems to be the primary benefactor of the pipeline's economic advantages. The president's administration has indicated that he will veto any attempt by Congress to assume direct control over the approval process. Without the pipeline's approval, Canada continues to seek an outlet to export its carbon-heavy crude oil.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
Are you not sure where to go on campus? Traveling late at night and afraid to go alone? Call SafeWalk, a free service where a co-ed team will take you anywhere you need to go on campus. Don't walk alone. For a walk, add SafeWalk to your phone. Call 604-822-5355. That's 604-822-5355. Alternatively, use a UBC Blue phone and ask for SafeWalk. Approach any SafeWalk team or drop by our office on the main floor of the sub across from the gallery lounge.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. Broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have our weekly science and technology segment with Marco.
This is Marco with CITR's Science and Technology News for Friday, November 14th. In our lead story, greenest automaker fined $100 million. The question in this story is, can consumers trust companies' info about their products when they buy these products like cars from Hyundai and Kia? This was the crucial question raised by the U.S. government when they fined Hyundai and Kia $100 million for apparently submitting inaccurate or false fuel economy and emission data. The EPA investigated after they received complaints from many consumers on 1.2 million of Kia's cars sold in the past 3 years in the U.S. So this does affect Canada. In the case in question, Kia and Hyundai underestimated emissions by 25%, equivalent to the emissions produced by a power plant powering 400,000 homes per year. So the question is this corporate counterfeit science? Hyundai and Kia seem to have cherry-picked its data to make its cars seem more fuel-efficient and greener. The complaints from Kia and Hyundai owners caused the EPA to investigate. In other news, in local news, UBC professor, marine biologist Chris Harley is now speaking out about the sea star wasting syndrome. Sea stars, or starfish, on coasts from BC to California are now being hit by a mysterious condition known as sea star wasting syndrome. 1 year ago, starfish started disintegrating and disappearing on the shores of Howe Sound. In questions to Professor Harley, he was asked, what is sea star wasting syndrome and what is causing it? The symptoms are dreadful, says the professor. First, the sea stars swell up, Then their limbs fall off. After this, their limbs crawl a few meters before they run out of gas. Once the stars or the sea stars started showing the symptoms, within 1 or 2 days, they will die. When asked what is causing this, Professor Harley says no one from BC to California is sure. In another question, how does the loss of sea star impact our ocean ecology? The professor said, and quote, sea stars are incredibly important ecologically. The intertidal sea stars are voracious predators of mussels. Take away the sea stars, and the mussels overgrow many other species, and these other species die. So as the goes the sea stars, so goes the shore. I will keep you updated with this story in the next few weeks. In other space news, the largest sunspot in 24 years is about to make a reappearance. On November 3rd, sunspot AR2192 disappeared because it rotated on the other side of the Earth, or out of Earth's view. But it is responsible for kicking up truly amazing solar activity the past few weeks. AR2192 has shot off many big and small solar flares, and this sunspot, which is huge, it's the size of Jupiter and 10 times the size of the Earth, is the 33rd biggest sunspot of the last 33,000 sunspots or active regions that have appeared since 1874. When NASA scientist Alex Young was asked, how does a sunspot grow this big? He says, quote, we really don't know. The latest sunspot cycle, which started in 2008, will end in 2019. So we are now close to the maximum or peak in the sunspot cycle. So there are many more concentrated magnetic fields and magnetic energy under the solar surface waiting to bubble up. The sunspot will reappear within the next week, so stay tuned. It may cause havoc. In other space news, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter spectrometer shows Oort cloud comet coming. Comet C/2013L sighting spring is now passing by Mars. The Reconnaissance Imaging Spectrometer for Mars, or CRISM, is observing this comet, and it is recording images of 107 different wavelengths of light coming off the comet. The images showing the inner cloud of dust and the nucleus, which is called the coma. Comets are material that have formed 4.6 billion years ago when the solar system started. The full spectrum still has to be analyzed to better understand the color variations in this comet. This comet is unlike Halley's Comet, which has come through the solar system many, many times. This is a pristine comet, and it is the first time it has come into the inner solar system. In other comet news, the Rosetta spacecraft lander, Philia, landed November 12th on comet C67, the first such landing in the history of our species. This is also a pristine comet, which is making its first appearance in the inner solar system, so scientists hope to learn more about comets by studying comet 67P. This comet, again, is a pristine comet, unlike comet Halley, which comes through our solar system every 87 years. In latest tests on 1987, when Halley came in, Soviet and American spacecrafts studied the composition of the comet and noted that the composition of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, or CHON, is almost in exact proportion to what is in a human body. So scientists are pondering what brought water to Earth. Well, it could have been the comets. Stay tuned. This is Marco. I will update you next week on this comet. You have listened to CITR's Science and Technology News.
Thank you, Marco. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments here on CITR 101.9 FM.
The Got Consent Initiative is a preventative campaign that creatively touches upon the necessity for consent to be present during all sexual encounters. The Got Consent branding is visible on a variety of clothing items, including t-shirts, underwear, and tank tops. It's also available at the SASC and the UBC Wellness Center in the sub, in addition to at My Sister's Closet. For more information on the Sexual Assault Support Center at UBC and the Got Consent campaign, go to ams.ubc.ca/SASC.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thanks for being with us.
Up next, we have an interview with Anne Berthissel, Research Investigation Director for STOP at UBC Animal Research, a group not responsible for the posters in question, but that has similar concerns about the use of animals in research at UBC. She explains the goals of the organization, concerns about animal research at UBC, and addresses the posters on campus. News correspondent Emily Blake spoke with Anne earlier this week.
I'm Anne Berthissel. I'm on the board of STOP UBC Animal Research, and I'm a member of the ADAC Society of British Columbia.
What are some of the goals of your organization?
STOP UBC's major campaign are to bring more disclosure about the types of research being done in Canadian institutions, to talk about the scientific aspects of why animal research is actually hazardous to human health, and to bring it down, not just animal welfare, but the fact we're saying it's bad science, and thousands of progressive scientists agree that animal research is not working and it's time to implement the alternative to a much greater degree.
Do you speak to researchers and scientists?
Like to, they don't attend to our dialogue. Basically, they shut down any chance for us to communicate with them, and they don't respond. Our director, Laura Lee Shaw, presented a petition to the Senate in April. 22,000 people signed our petition calling for an end to the most invasive and cruel categories of research, and there's been no response from the university. So basically what we asked for was not an immediate ban on animal research. We know that's not going to happen. We asked for what is a very achievable goal, which was category D and E experiments discontinued at UBC. Those are the two categories that allow for pain and suffering above the pain tolerance threshold. We find that almost a third of the research done on animals at UBC falls into those two worst categories.
And about the posters that I'm specifically referring to, there's some concerns that the photos that they're using are not actually from UBC.
Right, but what I'm seeing from the posters on campus is the same type of research, same type of invasive treatment of the animals. So basically they're not claiming that this is taken in UBC researchers' lab. They're just saying this is the same type of research. At least a few of the researchers in the neurological department are doing it, we see.
I was actually speaking to her earlier today.
Can I ask what her response was to the poster?
She said that she does care about the animals a lot, and that it's not her first choice to use animals, and she tries to treat them the best that she can, but that in a lot of cases, unfortunately, you know, animals are the best models that they have to use for testing.
That is actually a very controversial subject. Many scientists are saying that using monkey cells, as she is doing in Parkinson's disease research, is completely invalid. She can only simulate symptoms of Parkinson's disease. She can't actually cause it. And where she says she cares about the animals, I've heard things that she thinks those her children. Well, I think that she could easily be accused of child abuse if that's what she would do to a child. I mean, we've had our scientific advisor who's looked at some of her papers and called her work proven shocking what she's been doing to animals. The scans that she makes can be used on actual Parkinson's patients doing a variety of cognitive tasks that the monkeys can't even do. There's tremendous work being done elsewhere. There's all kinds of techniques that they use, especially in Europe and especially in England, and they're falling way behind if we persist in trying to make new models of human diseases. Humans and macaque monkeys are separated by 25 million years of evolution. It's known that one evolved complex system can't predict the effect of a drug on another evolved complex system. You know, we share some of our DNA with a banana, but you can't test anything on a banana and expect it to relate to the human system.
What steps do you see as necessary to achieving some of these goals?
I think there are some researchers at You see, doing great stuff with making greatest use of computer work, of the new technologies of DNA, not focusing on trying to replicate human diseases in animals, but actually looking at the human being, using cell cultures, using simulations. There's a number of tremendous innovative alternatives that are just underfunded, and we'd like to promote the use of the alternatives. We'd like to hear from the researchers at UBC not doing animal work, but using these alternatives. So basically, we'd like to see a greater focus on the reallocation of funding to non-animal research. That's the way the world is going, and I hate to see Vancouver and British Columbia falling behind. We need to be at the forefront instead. We're looking backwards to the old days, the old dark days of animal research.
And if you had the opportunity to speak to researchers that are using animals, what would you say?
I want them to validate for me why they feel that it's even permissible to inflict pain and suffering that we know is involved in animal research. We know as soon as you've taken an animal, either from the wild or you've bred it for animal research, it's going to face the life of pain, suffering. It's being denied its basic nature, its freedom, and it's generally going to suffer from the stress. The very least in scanning, and how can that research be so desensitized to suffering if he is supposed to be a humanitarian? Why is 60% of the research at UBC just curiosity-driven research, not actually looking for a cure, adding to the scientific knowledge that's already out there? Can he prove to me that he isn't replicating somebody else's experiment? He's just tweaking it a little bit. You know, has he searched a database of alternatives? It's a simple web search to find out if there's an alternative. And he needs to prove to me that why he can't use that alternative. He needs to speak with our scientific guides. I'd like to know why, if animals are, you know, close enough to us to study it biologically and expect some kind of answer to the human system, then why should that animal not be more respected if he's so like us? How can we abuse him this way? We need more details.
Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me.
Next, Emily spoke with Dr. Doris Ducey, a professor of neurology and a member of the Pacific Parkinson's Research Center and Brain Center. Recently, posters have surfaced on campus from animal rights activists expressing concern about Dr. Ducey's use of macaque monkeys in her research. She explains what? She explains why animals are still used in research and addresses ethical concerns.
I am professor in the Department of Medicine, Division of Neurology. I am also a member of the Brain Research Center and the Pacific Parkinson's Research Center.
Would you mind maybe explaining some of your research?
For the last 30 years, then, I have been interested in two main aspects, which are actually interrelated. One is Parkinson's disease, and the other one is mood disorder, depression. Both of them are different aspects of dysfunction in a type of neurotransmitter, like chemicals in the brain. So what I have been interested in is basically to look at the function of this monoaminergic system, so dopamine, serotonin, and noradrenaline, in both Parkinson and mood disorder.
So recently, a bunch of posters have been posted around campus with concerns about the use of macaque monkeys in your research. So when did these posters come to your attention?
A friend of mine on Sunday sent me a picture of a poster, so it was maybe 3 weeks ago.
What was your initial reaction when you saw the photo?
I was angry. It does not reflect at all what I do. I think they recognize this picture of being from Germany. I believe they are from the Max Planck Institute. And this picture do not reflect reality at all. Neither of my research, but it also does not reflect the reality of people who are doing research that are doing neuronal recording in awake behaving primate.
So the poster specifically made an allegation that, quote, you're responsible for poisoning at least 18 macaque monkeys with neurotoxins to give them brain damage and Parkinson-like symptoms, unquote. What is the truth behind these comments, or where is this coming from?
Around 1979, 1980, in California, a number of neurologists having dinner one night started talking about their patient. And several of them noticed that they had very young people arriving in their hospital with severe stage 5 Parkinson's disease. And they investigated what was common between these young people. A lot of them were drug addicts, and they were buying a synthetic heroin. So the chemist did not recrystallize the synthetic heroin properly, and he made a compound which ended up being known as MPTP. The best model that we have right now of Parkinson's disease is by giving to monkeys, by giving the drug MPTP. So yes, I have indeed administered MPTP to a number of monkeys, and I do have to say some of these monkeys, I worked with them for another 15 or 20 years. I had 4 animals, I think, where I gave them one dose and they became completely Parkinsonian like the patient. Most of the other animals, you can actually give them low doses and the animals start developing some slowness of movement and some rigidity and even some type of tremor. But they remain able to jump and run, to interact with one another, to groom one another, and to have a somewhat normal life, the same way that a Parkinson patient would be. And these animals, over the 18 animals they talk about, was probably over 25 years. So to some extent, this is true and it is not true, is that, you know, yes, I have given Parkinson's disease to some monkeys, but these animals have had a useful life for research for over 25 years because after they have the disease, the only thing I do with them is basically image them and look at how does the disease progress.
How would you respond to ethical concerns about these types of testing?
Believe it or not, I am an animal lover. I have a lot of animals. Most of them have been stray or have been abandoned. And I like animals. However, a lot of the research have to look at the benefit as well as the loss. It is true that we are using animals which are maybe not sentient in the way that humans are sentient. They probably do not have the same moral value, if you want, than human. But it is true they can feel pain. So what we do is that we make sure that everything we do is made to minimize or even abolish all of the pain that could be inflicted and all of the stress. The animals are actually handled in the best position with the best of care. We do everything to basically mitigate what we need to do to them. Every single person I know that does research with animals, we are all really trying our best to do whatever we need to do, but with the utmost care for the animals that we are using.
Is there anything else that you'd like people to know, especially animal rights activists?
I agree to some extent with them that we need to keep developing alternatives to animal research. But to say you have to stop doing research on animals right now, this is not possible.
Are you personally doing anything to counter these claims?
I have actually been working with the VP Research Office, and I want to actually increase that type of work. You know, recently, UBC in the last 2 or 3 years has been trying to increase their transparency. They have published a number of animals they were using. They have published the report of CCAC. I think there is more that we can do. And you have to basically tell the public exactly what you are doing and why you are doing it. I mean, UBC is doing probably more than many other universities in Canada, but we are still not doing enough to publicize the research. People are not stupid. If we explain to them why, then it will be difficult for animal activists to actually come and spread lies unchallenged.
Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you, Emily. You too.
We're going to take a quick PSA break. Thank you, Emily, for that segment. But stay tuned for more News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Right to Play is an international humanitarian organization using sport and play programs to encourage the healthy physical, social, and emotional development of the world's most disadvantaged children. RTP at UBC is run by a team of committed university students who advocate sport for development, and it is the first university chapter of its kind. We want you to get involved. Together, we can educate students about sport for development, help raise money, and teach children here in the Lower Mainland about the importance of sport and a healthy lifestyle. So check us out at www.interchange.ubc.ca/RTPUBC.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
For our next segment on the show, we have an interview with Professor James Ridge from the Vantage College to discuss some of the concerns which have been raised about their program. News correspondent Morgan Yee spoke with James earlier this week.
James, welcome to News 101.
Thank you very much, and again, thanks for your interest in Vantage.
I guess the best place to start would be for you to tell us a little bit about what Vantage College is.
We offer a unique first year initially in arts and science. Next year we'll be including engineering and management for international students who are a little bit weaker in English. So that's sort of the primary purpose. It allows us to reach into countries and school systems where certainly we've not drawn a lot of students, in large part because the students are a little weaker in English. Many universities in Canada have something similar. I think where Vantage is unique is that we're not arm's length from the main university. We are an integral academic unit. Our faculty are tenure track UBC faculty. Our staff are UBC staff. And our students, when they arrive, even for the Vantage first year, are full UBC students. They are AMS members. You know, they join all the clubs. They live in residence, et cetera, et cetera. So we're very excited about the program. I think it allows us to bring international students who are, you know, really academically qualified. And I want to stress they have to be as academically qualified as any other international student coming to UBC. They can't be academically weak. But it allows us to give these students a path into UBC that they wouldn't otherwise have.
And how many students will Vantage be working with each year?
This year's our first year. We have 188 students, and we plan to grow. Our target is about 400 next year, 600 the year after. We're hoping to get to 1,000 students would be our steady state, so we don't really anticipate growing a whole lot larger than that.
And there'll be separate housing for Vantage students, correct?
Well, yes and no. Right now, our 188 students are actually living in Place Vanier. The university is building Orchard Commons, it's under construction now. It's a large project, and it includes essentially an academic wing for Vantage College of classrooms, offices, teaching and learning spaces, etc. But the vast majority of it, almost 80% of it, is residence space, about 1,040-odd residence beds, and a large dining hall. That portion of it will be occupied by all university students, domestic and international, and that's been misrepresented out there to our frustration. What we've heard over and over again, which is just patently false, is that this $127 million complex is being built for Vantage College. Absolutely untrue. Vantage is occupying about 20% of it. Vantage will pay the mortgage or debt, and that payment comes entirely from Vantage College program revenues, so other students aren't paying for that. And of course, the reason we picked 1,000 additional residents beds is precisely so that when Vantage College does get to 1,000 students, we're not having a detrimental impact on the overall sort of resident stock in the university. So if we're going to add 1,000 international students, we have to add 1,000 beds. But again, our students will be mixed in to maybe three different residences.
Going back to the planning process for Vantage, when was this idea first conceived and who was involved?
So the conversation really started about 3 years ago. There were a whole range of people involved, from the key faculties, the recruiters, the registrar's office. I was registrar at the time, so I was at the table. We've also had the AMS involved pretty much from the outset. So the AMS Academic Vice President has been involved in these conversations for at least two and a half years. We made a deliberate point of having the AMS sort of actively engaged in these conversations, precisely so that there was a student voice at the table.
Now, there are a lot of other universities and colleges who run similar programs to Vantage, but some of them, GreenPath in Toronto, for example, they offer a three-month intensive English program. Why did Vantage choose to go the route of a full year program?
I think we just thought that was better than simply doing a largely English language programming. Plus, of course, our English Language Institute in Continuing Studies actually has sort of pre-university English preparation and English language upgrading program. I think one of the benefits of our program is because you can do your English language upgrading in parallel with your first year of academic studies, we've heard from a lot of students, this actually saves them time and money. But actually, most of the models we looked at were full first-year models. Simon Fraser is a full first year. We went down to Oregon State, where there's an English company called Into has partnered with Oregon State. They have a full first-year program. So we were looking at that model almost from the start. We really didn't want to engage with a private sector partner, so where Vantage is unique is how to do it ourselves.
Now, Vantage is a $127 million project. So if you're not partnered with a private company, where is this funding coming from?
That's all in the public record. It's approved by the Board of Governors. It's a loan from the UBC Endowment. Has to be paid back with interest.
And now looking at the cost of the Vantage program, on the website it says it's about $50,000, including your housing, your food, things like that. For other international students who are doing their first year of general arts, including their program fees, housing, food, spending money, etc. That's calculated by the UBC tuition calculator at sitting about $40,000. Can you explain why you think the Vantage program is worth that extra $10,000?
The way we got to our $30,000 program fee was pretty simple. We took the sort of lowest level of international tuition, which was roughly $23,000, and we added essentially a $7,000 Vantage College program fee, which covers a number of things. First of all, it covers the fact that our program is 11 months, not 8 months, so you're getting a few extra months of actual instructional time and content. It's actually a heavier credit load than most first-year students take, and most of which are transferable, of course. We also include Jumpstart, which most international students have to pay extra for. We also have smaller classes. That tends to be a little more expensive.
There's been a lot of discussion, as I'm sure you know, in the media about who exactly Vantage is targeting in terms of student recruitment. Would it be fair to say that Vantage is primarily looking to bring in students from China and Hong Kong on the website? The only other language represented is...
Yeah, well, let me step back a bit. First of all, that's categorically false. The vast majority of our recruiting effort and money is going into places other than China. To say, when I've read some of the comments, how quickly this gets to just utterly racist comments is deeply, deeply disturbing. We have a large number of Chinese students at UBC, and they are superb students. So, yes, we have a lot of students from China at Vantage College. We did very little, if any, recruiting and marketing there. You're quite right. One of our farms there, but that's super a function of timing, I suppose. We're actually translating some of our key material in a whole range of languages. We just had access to that translation capacity a bit earlier. So you will see, I think if you come back in a few weeks, we'll have a lot more languages there. Unfortunately, the CBC article coincided with us only having one translation document up there, but I really do, as you can probably tell, bristle a bit at that characterization.
Concerns have also been raised in regards to Vantage becoming this ivory tower of achievement on the campus that most students just don't have access to. They don't have access to that level of service. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, and again, I kind of bristle at that, too, when I've heard it a few times in the last week. First of all, you know, paint the big picture. When I look at what international students, any international student is going to pay in international tuition over a four-year degree here, our program is about a 7 to 8% premium on that. So, the idea that this is elite when, in fact, they're paying maybe 7 or 8% more is stretching things just a bit.
Is there any link between Vantage College and the international student tuition fees going up, or is that just a coincidence that the tuition increases blew up sort of around the same time that Vantage College really started hitting the media?
There isn't a link, let's put it that way. Vantage isn't receiving that additional revenue or anything like that. So there's no financial link between that tuition increase and Vantage. I've heard some crazy theories that, it was to pay for the building, et cetera, which it absolutely isn't.
As a representative of Vantage, how do you respond to comments that argue that the money that's being spent on Vantage, this $127 million for the building, that it should be spent on domestic students or on international students who are already here and are already struggling?
Well, again, I think it will. there's no question that international students generally in every university in North America is facing this reality. International students have a positive financial impact on the university. The international students, not just Vantage, but international students generally at UBC allow us to actually have places for about 1,000 domestic students that we wouldn't otherwise have funding for. Put a different way, we have 1,000 more domestic students than the province gives us money for. And the only reason we have those 1,000 additional domestic students is because of the revenues from international students.
And I think that's everything I have for you today. So thank you very much for your time, James.
No problem.
Thank you to Professor Ridge and to Morgan Yee for that interview.
You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver and online at citr.ca. Thank you for being with us.
Up next on the program, we have a brief discussion with City Council candidate Ludwig Skaliki about his experiences running as an independent candidate in the upcoming Vancouver elections. He joined news correspondent Morgan Yee at CITR earlier today.
My name is Ludwig Skaliki. Basically, I'm from the downtown east side, been there, living there for the last 27 years. I am a struggling actor on TV and films, as well as an advocate. I don't fit the criteria of being as a mentally ill person in the downtown east side, which everybody has been stigmatized with. And considering that you've got so many families and residences, areas that live in the downtown east side, in that zone, and you're only concentrating on just the people that are using drugs or that are mentally ill, and that's no way of classifying everybody in the downtown east side.
Now, it's my understanding that this is your first time being involved in municipal politics.
Yes.
What's that experience been like for you, and particularly because you are from the downtown east side?
Well, for the first time ever running as a candidate, I've actually found it very interesting. I've seen the conditions, what we have to go for as running as an independent, and it's absolutely ridiculous. When we abide by the rules, of the rules that are given to us from the City of Vancouver by not having stands, leaflets, flyers, and we're just canvassing individually, we're trying to get at meetings. The biggest problem that I found out was that all these meetings that they have, all candidates' meetings, it's not designed for the independents. Independents are not even invited. When we show up, we are denied to have a seat or to even answer any of the questions that the people want answered, right? And this is the biggest issue. The campaigning and everything else is taken over by these groups, right? And yet we have no say in it as an independent.
And I guess my last question for you then, for people who are voting in the downtown east side, mm-hmm. where can they go on Saturday?
On Saturday, it will be at the Carnegie Center.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
No problem.
To find out more about Ludwig Skalitsky's experiences running as an independent candidate, contact him at his email address, lud65@hotmail.com.
That's our program for today, November 14th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website at citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Costa Perdanovich.
And I'm Alex Sarah Davis. Today's broadcast was produced by Alberto Montilla. From the entire news team here at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded right here on CITR 101.9 FM.